Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. It's a lovely sunny spring day here in Belfast, so what better than sharing some of the amazing stories from our recent event in the Roe Valley Arts Centre in Limavady.
So I asked him, do you know how poops work? He said, yes, I know how poops work. I said, I don't think you know how poops work because you're listening to his heart. He said, I know how poops work. We did a whole semester on how poops work in medical school.
My friend remarked the unevenness of the ground, which was definitely a bit rocky. It was only when she kept on saying it, even when we reached a flat stretch, that we realised one of the heels of her shoes had broken off.
The next afternoon, my superpower became apparent. I could see ghosts. An anxious spectre of jittery red hair was sitting staring up at the high TV. Stephen?
Three very different stories, all told on April 26th when the theme was coming home. And it was a brilliant evening, as always. And we start this podcast with a first timer. Here's Mike Carlisle.
On the 23rd of December 2020, we entered hospital holding a two-week-old baby who had jaundice and came home holding a two-week-old baby with a congenital heart condition, and it nearly wrecked us. But first, anxiety is a wide-ranging phenomenon. For example, there's the anxiety experienced when we realize we've built our entire lives and emotional processing system incorrectly, leading to learned self-destructive behavior, or as the poet John O'Donohue writes, traveled too fast over false ground. And then there's anxiety of being next in line, waiting for a table at the cool new coffee shop, while takeaway customers are filing in and out, and you can clearly see that there are only two whoopies available behind that plexiglass. My daughter and I are eagerly watching these to-go fools order brownies and scones when there are whoopies available. At the same time, both scornful at their inferior choices, but also very grateful that they haven't chosen those whoopies because we want those whoopies. Those of you who don't know what whoopies are, they are two cookies held together by a meringue-like substance. For those of you who knew exactly what whoopies are, may I be probably not the first to say that food will never fill that love-shaped hole in your heart. Also, please get checked for diabetes. While suffering from anxiety, I was prone to panic attacks, and panic attacks hit you like a sucker punch out of nowhere. One minute, you're walking down the street, living your little middle-class life, then you see a sign on a Starbucks window that says, go all out on pumpkin spice. And you think, what more could we possibly pumpkin spice? Surely there are no more things to pumpkin spice. What is pumpkin spice? Pumpkins are not spicy, and I'm so white I sometimes find garlic too hot. Why are they saying pumpkins are spicy? Enough of the lies, Starbucks! Then bam, panic attack. And you're fighting for breath while trying to find the nearest enclosed space to hide because pumpkins aren't spicy. I don't know if you've ever tried hyperventilating in a public toilet, but as you breathe in remnant vapors of a thousand other guys' excrement, you do find yourself thinking, this room could really use a pumpkin spice air freshener. You win this round, Starbucks! My own mental health issues stem in part from my son having a congenital heart condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And those words are as much fun to try and say as they are to deal with on a daily basis. So on the 23rd of December 2020, my two-week-old son's jaundice was so bad and his skin was so yellow that I was certain that Jim Davidson was about to tell a joke and use him as the punchline. His stomach was really bloated and he hadn't pooped in a week. For those of you who don't have kids, those are not good signs. There are two things they tell you to do when your two-week-old son hasn't pooped within the second half of his life. The first one is laxatives. Already being the father of two children, having been the subject to many's a diarrhea fountain, I felt that giving laxative to a baby was the equivalent of using a heated chainsaw to cut a slice of butter. But we did it anyway, and it proved to be ineffective. The second thing that they suggested we do was anal stimulation. Now, I'm a clean living man. But I don't care how clean you are, how old you are, how sensible you are, or how important your job is. You try not giggling when the gruff Glaswegian man at the end of the NHS 24 hotline asks you the question, have you tried anal stimulation? My task for the day was to put some Vaseline on this little finger and stick it up my baby son's little bottom. And what I learned from that experience is it takes a long time for your teenage children to look you in the eyes after accidentally walking in the middle of that. But the good news is it was also ineffective. I stuck my digit up my son's bottom for no good reason. And we were called to the hospital immediately. In-laws left in charge of the bigger kids, and off we went. At this point, I was feeling very nonchalant about the whole thing. I entered the hospital snacking. Don't worry, I wash my hands well. I was chomping down on some yogurt-covered raisins. Pumpkin spice flavor, of course. A young doctor started listening to my son's belly with a stethoscope. I don't know what possessed him, but this doctor decided that yellow skin, no poops, and a bloated belly were symptoms pointing to my son's heart. So I asked him, do you know how poops work? He said, yes, I know how poops work. I said, I don't think you know how poops work because you're listening to his heart. He said, I know how poops work. We did a whole semester on how poops work in medical school. He said, I don't think you know how poops work because I've never had trouble pooping, and shouted, call an ambulance. This is the first sign of a cardiac arrest. He said, I know how poops work. I'm a doctor. In that moment, I wanted to see this man's medical diploma. I considered asking for a substitution, but apparently sharing the same initial letter is the only similarity between the NHS and the NBA. This guy was all I was getting. He listened to my son's heart for a minute or two, turned to the nurse and said, can you go and call in the pediatric cardiology consultant? Here's something that may shock you. When they call in the pediatric cardiology consultant, they rarely call them in to ask if they want a few yogurt-covered raisins. It's worse than that. They usually call them in when there's a problem with your child's pediatric heart cardiology. And that's the worst kind of reason you want anyone called in to meet your two-week-old son. There was a problem with his heart. They had to perform a barrage of tests, and they had to perform them now. I was no longer feeling nonchalant. If anything, I would describe my mental state at that moment as very chalant. They carted my baby and wife away to another part of the hospital, and I was left with the instruction, go back home, get a change of clothes for your wife and son. They will be here overnight. On the 23rd of December, 2020, my wife and my baby boy were going to wake up on Christmas Eve in Alton McGowan Hospital at the height of COVID. I went home to surmise that the sauce that I'd left for the older kids past the dinner had been mistaken by my mother-in-law for grouting by the amount of it that was all over the wall behind the cooker. And these are the sort of things in those situations that you know you should be far too focused on life and death to get really annoyed at them, but in the back of your mind you're thinking, you do realize pots have lids, don't you? I packed up the things and headed back to the hospital. When I got there, a nurse grabbed me by the arm and said, if you can wait around for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, we might be able to send your wife and your baby boy home with you tonight. Which sounds like good news, but Strictly was starting in 45 minutes. But I stayed because love requires sacrifice, and what can I say? I'm a good person. I waited 3 hours because I'm actually a really good person. It was then pronounced that we could all go home. And as we were leaving, we cried all the way down the corridor walking out. We cried in the ticket machine shelter. We cried walking over to the car, and we cried the entire drive home. We didn't know what to say to each other to make any of this better, because the only information we had learned that day was there something wrong with our baby boy's heart. Well, that and anal stimulation doesn't necessarily make everybody poop. We came home, I wiped down the kitchen tiles, made some late dinner for the two of us, and sat down, opened a beer. Tomorrow was Christmas Eve. My wife was home. My baby was home. I was home. And for this moment, at least, I was happy. And that was the start of my 18-month journey of unprompted rage and inanimate objects, tears over table settings, and then eventually some therapy. And I will end with two pieces of information that you may be hoping for resolution on. The first one is, my son is alive and well and developing nicely. And the second one is, no, I never did get to see that episode of Strictly.
Thanks so much, Mike. What a wonderful mix of emotions in that story. Great to hear the baby is thriving. And I won't be making any comments on anal stimulation. Nope, not one. We're always looking for new storytellers at 10x9, so if you've got a story you'd like to tell, just like Mike there, then get in touch at 10x9.com. I'll be more than happy to help out. Okay, on to our next story, and it was only her second visit to the 10x9 mic. Here's Alice Lewis.
It was a New Year's Eve in the mid-90s, and my friend Joanne and I had been invited to a house party somewhere in Inishowen. We were in our first or second year of university in Dublin, and the invite was one of those slightly random ones through a friend of a friend who was themselves probably more of a casual acquaintance. Rumour had it that the house had been the former holiday home of John Hume, but now belonged to this friend of a friend's parents. This connection added a certain frisson to the invitation. We may have been self-absorbed 19-year-olds, but we recognised something special in John Hume, a true statesman who was negotiating the seemingly impossible at the time. I borrowed my dad's car and drove myself and my friend up there from Belfast. To this day, I really couldn't tell you where it was. I'm guessing it was near Muff, but that generally gets a laugh. I remember it had a long garden which stretched down to the loch shore. Little did I know then I would end up living just across that loch 20 years later. We arrived with a carry-out, I've no doubt. It's all quite hazy, but I do remember at one stage we all tripped out of the house to go to the local pub to see in midnight. This involved walking down the slope of the back garden to access a path that ran along the shore and up into whatever village or pub it was. My friend remarked the unevenness of the ground, which was definitely a bit rocky, but she'd also had a few drinks by this stage. It was only when she kept on saying it, even when we reached a flat stretch, that we realised one of the heels of her shoes had broken off, and she was literally walking with a 2-inch list to one side. That caused a lot of tipsy hilarity and became a much recounted anecdote of the night. At some stage, much later on, back at the house party, I found a bed and fell into it. I awoke the next morning feeling sicker than I have ever before or have since. A few stragglers were still in the house, and I remember someone trying to find tea bags. I bemoaned just how dreadful I felt. Incredibly, the consensus was that it must have been a bad pint at the pub. Has ever a more responsibility-denying excuse been given? Ah, yes, that one bad pint. Nothing to do with the many and varied alcoholic drinks I had consumed, the lack of food, and no doubt smoking too. Anyway, the problem was that despite feeling utterly wretched, I had no choice but to drive us home to Belfast again. At this stage, I should declare I realised the risk I took and the danger I exposed us to, and I shudder to think of what could have happened. I'm not even sure it was acceptable in the 90s. We got into my dad's car. Now, Joanne, my friend, was well known for her bubbliness, a euphemism for the fact that she liked to talk a lot, with minimal or no prompting. She was also renowned for her prolonged bouts of deep body-shaking laughter. She was capable of sustaining these for many minutes at a time, covering quite an extraordinary range of pitches, from high whoops to deep guttural throbs. Once she started, it was hard to get her stopped. Normally, these were quite charming and entertaining attributes in a friend, especially when well diluted in a crowd. But on that painful journey, as I gripped the steering wheel and tried to focus through bleary eyes, a blinding headache and churning stomach, It was absolute torture. I just wanted her to please God stop talking and, oh dear Lord, please silence the cackling. Looking back, she was probably still drunk. I believe I pulled the car over twice to be sick. I'm not proud of this story. And possibly also just to get my head showered away from Joanne. I thought it might help, but sadly not. I remember the frosty air of the first day of January and snow on the ground as I retched at the side of the road. At long, long last, we reached my parents' house. I stumbled through the door, looking white and ill. Now, my mum and dad were pioneers. For those of you who don't know, this is and was a religious movement that promoted lifelong abstinence from alcohol of any kind. As non-drinkers themselves, they utterly failed to recognise the obvious signs and no doubt smells of a serious hangover. Instead, they thought their poor wee Alice had come down with something. I was promptly whisked to the sofa where I was swaddled in blankets. Sweet tea and wheaten toast with honey were provided and refills kept coming in a steady stream. I totally regressed. No longer was I an independent young woman living away from home at university. I was a sick child who just wanted to be looked after. My chatty friend now had a receptive audience and she sat happily drinking tea and regaling my parents. My mum was a pretty formidable chatter herself, so the crack was 90. I leant my poor head back on the cushions and dozed gently while their chatter provided a pleasant, faraway backdrop. When Joanne finally left, I always remember her comment, "Al, your mum is just so maternal." It revealed much about both our very different experiences of mothers. I'd always taken my mum's solicitude for granted and even found it a bit annoying at times. By contrast, Joanne was astonished and quite envious of a level of care of concern with which she was wholly unfamiliar. If she'd come home in that state, she would have got a very different reception. Mind you, her mum took a drink, so she probably would have realised the damage was self-inflicted. Joanne also noted with incredulity that she had drunk 17 cups of tea that afternoon without once needing the toilet. I think that demonstrates our general level of post-party dehydration and clearly her much stronger constitution. I tell this fairly inconsequential story as when I think about what coming home meant, really it was about coming back to the comfort and safety of mum's love. Whether that was freshly made scones, sitting on a tea towel when we got in from school, or shepherd's pie straight out of the oven. One of the best things was coming home in the early hours on a freezing cold or wet night. I gingerly make my way upstairs, trying not to wake anyone, and I'd find the warmth of a hot water bottle in my bed, left by mum, my nightdress wrapped around it. Sometimes when we didn't come home, home came to us. I'm the youngest of 10, and all of us crossed the Irish Sea at some point. Many never came back. When I lived in London with my brother Michael, I remember one Tuesday morning, a slightly greasy package plopped through the letterbox. We unwrapped layers of string, sellotape, kitchen paper, baking parchment, to find four of my mum's squidgy homemade pancakes inside. Remarkably, not much the worse of their journey. Turned out it was pancake, or if you were my mum, it was Shrove Tuesday. Mum had risen early on the Monday morning, made a load of pancakes, and had my dad parcel them up, hot-foot it to the post office, and send them first class to all her children in England. The idea was that they would arrive the next morning and give us a taste of home, but I have a feeling there was an ulterior motive, and that she actually wanted to give us a nudge that it was the start of Lent and that we should go to Mass. When my mum passed away, home, or rather the house we grew up in, became a shell overnight. Lacking the literal warmth of the solid fuel Rayburn stove my mum tended 24 hours a day, and the spiritual warmth of her vitality and love. Somehow the room seemed smaller, the ornaments a bit tawdry, the carpet more worn, like Philip Larkin's poem, Home is So Sad. Happily, coming home nowadays means coming back to the home I've created with my own little family. I still make scones and pancakes, and I do the hot water bottle thing for my daughter. She loves it. I look ahead and I hope that no matter where they go, our children will always want to come home the way I did.
Oh, Alice, thanks so much. You're poor, naive, pioneer parents, but oh so lovely. I hope you'll be back with more soon. I know I do this on every podcast, but I think it's really important to say thank you to all the people who help keep Temba 9 going with donations either through Patreon or at the live events. It's really important that Temba 9 remains free of charge, and while we keep our overheads low, we do have some costs such as the website and recording devices, etc. So, thank you. We are truly grateful. Okay, here's our third and final story on this podcast, and it's an incredibly powerful one. Mark McGrath first came to Temba 9 when we went to Derry. His stories are always amazing, but just to let you know, this deals with mental health issues, including self-harm and suicide. But it is never less than brilliantly honest.
There's a stench on me, a horrible stench. Stephen's words still haunt me. He was the most fragile soul I met in a secure unit in Grangewood. Fear poured out of his saucer eyes onto the floor. He had two elderly parents who wore a precursor to grief in their faces. They searched the eyes of others in soft terror for answers. Anything to ease a suicidal weight on their baby boy's shoulders. Me and Stephen were a pair of lost souls in that regard. Medication was failing us both. As we peered into the social abyss, we tried to pass what felt like borrowed time between us. We talked about different books. I showed Stephen the Marvel encyclopedia that my daughter had given me. It felt like the kids were with me when I opened it up. It helped anchor me in thoughts of them watching cartoons. I wouldn't be able to read that, Stephen jittered. He pointed in soft frustration to his head. It's the shocks. They make it hard to concentrate. He told me that he listened to audiobooks instead. He was on his third cycle of ECT. It left him a little confused, but it seemed to work for him, for most of the week at least. It was on the eve of another session that I found Stephen talking about the non-existent stench that wouldn't leave him. He was as close to self-crucifixion in that moment that I had seen anyone, and it genuinely worried me. I had to tell someone. I found a CPN, a genuinely lovely guy. I watched him go out to Stephen and headed to my room. On arrival in a suicide ward, the nurses monitor you every 15 minutes. This is tilted more heavily towards precaution than to showing any regard for intrusion in your personal space. That space is anything but safe or certain on arrival. It's the most attention any of us will get in our lives, and we're in the least lucid state to appreciate it. I'm not sure if the 15-minute vigil was reinstated for Stephen that evening. The cocktail of drugs that I was on did occasionally put me out for the night. It's difficult to harm yourself in Grangewood. You're not allowed any sharp or metallic objects. No phone wires. You give your phone to a CPN who charges it for you. You have your room, some books, earphones so you can listen to music, or audiobooks in Stephen's case. You get one insubstantial bedsheet to get you through the night, not much of a margin for comfort. Then there's the pacifying pills to supposedly seal the deal. I was in that medicinal nighttime stupor, so I didn't hear the nurses panic when they found Stephen bleeding out in his bed. First I knew something was up was when he didn't appear for breakfast the next morning. I scanned the ward for him. Maybe he'd gone home. As much as I hoped that he'd experienced a miraculous recovery, his bleak rhetoric the day before was not born of any healing trajectory. His room door was open, but I was sure I hadn't found his tomb with the stone rolled back. The body wasn't missing because of any medical resurrection. I sat down for breakfast, aware that my psychiatric review was coming later that day. Then I went back to my room and cried as silently as I could. My review was the usual rickety wheel of pick a random pill and move from the previous failed one. I tried to be cautiously optimistic. Do you feel you're improving, Mark? Getting a few more minutes sleep was the kind of slow progress I didn't appreciate back then. At a snail's pace. I remember the psychiatrist smiling at my response. Well, let's see if we can speed that up. As I moved back to the ward, I looked over at the empty sofa. I went into my room and opened the Marvel Superheroes book, trying to draw a superpower out of the page. I wished for one that would turn me into a normal dad for my kids. Or super hearing, so I could find a friend who was somewhere out in time and space, hopefully still okay. The next afternoon, my superpower became apparent. I could see ghosts. An anxious specter of jittery red hair was sitting staring up at the high TV. Stephen? He flinched as I sat beside him. His arms were still bleeding and bandaged from wrist to elbow. The jittery ghost followed my eyes to his bandaged arms. He looked bewildered. He put a shaky finger up, pointing at his head. I don't remember doing it. The shocks, they make me forget. He stared into the ground and spoke softly. I heard the nurses say it was a ring pull from a can. Don't know how I got it. Stephen looked up at me like a frightened child. He touched his temple tenderly, the briefest moment of self-affection in that gesture. It works for me, ECT. I know people tell scary stories about it, but it worked for me. His eyes welled up. I don't know what I'll do when they stop the treatment. I'm afraid of that. I'm really afraid. The best version of a broken me back then searched for the right words to say. I felt like I was at the funeral of a man who's still at his faculties. How do you turn someone from feeling suicidal when you're sitting beside him with a similar death wish? A year later, a psychiatrist would tell me I was too clever for my own good, always searching for answers outside their instructions. They had dismissed my iatrogenic damage from pills as grim fantasy, claiming my search for a solution was a false dawn for delusional health anxiety. I always found this a strange take from supposed people of science. For me, searching for cures was an immensely rational approach. I wanted to play the game of percentages, find the most effective solution, weigh up the pros and cons. Tablets weren't working. They were now causing, rather than killing, my anxiety. As part of my search for forbidden fruit, I read about ECT. I knew it was a gamble, but I knew it worked miraculously for some people. Right now, I remember something that could help Stephen. There's maintenance ECT, Stephen. They give it once a month. You could speak to doctors here about it. He looked up as bright as I'd ever seen him. A smile filled his face. You can? Yeah, I read about it online in medical journals. It's an option that would always be there for you. I was a critically ill man, sharing a modest apple from the tree of knowledge with another fallen atom. 20 years of tablets, 20 years of chemicals for Stephen. All the guy needed was hope, a sense of future in any form of a solution, one that someone cared enough to give him. There's something else I wish I'd said, but I lost touch with Stephen when I was sent home. I know this will sound strange to say about a suicide attempt, but there was an obvious positive in there. Not the act itself. Trying to self-terminate is always a bad thing. But that sheer resourcefulness in Stephen finding a way to do it when he was stuck in a place that made it near impossible. That takes ingenuity. That's a real life skill. It was just pointed in the polar opposite direction. Left to their own self-loathing, people will carry a planet on their shoulders. They take that superhuman strength for granted because we dismiss them as broken people, failing to separate their illness from their superpowers of resilience and surviving the struggle. If you're worried about someone out there feeling the edges, focus on their bravery and not the reasons that they need to be brave. Too many close the book on their superhero potential because they wrongly believe that the world doesn't want to hear their story. Without a positive voice about them, they sit alone, home turning into hell as they feel like they were set on fire. Shout about their resilience from the rooftops when they stand dejected at the ledge. Remind them of their incredible strength in thawing the flames that burn through them. They might then open a Marvel Superheroes encyclopedia and see themselves on it. A human torch lighting a path of endurance for others.
Mark, thanks for that incredibly raw insight into your life. You're amazing and inspirational. And after he told that story, Mark emailed to say he'd been approached by a woman in the audience who runs a suicide prevention group and wanted him to speak to them, which is great. He went on, 10 by 9 is making it possible for me to reach other people who might need to know it's possible to turn it all around. I don't think it will ever be possible to thank you enough for that. And that's it for this podcast. Check out all the upcoming events on our website, 10by9.com. They are updated regularly, and be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. We won't flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks as always to everyone who makes 10by9 happen, the wonderful people at Roe Valley, Denise and the team, Shona, Maureen and Eve. Special thanks to Mark Culberton, the sound engineer, who saved the day with his backup recording. And thanks too to the Limavady audience, which was so supportive and warm. And of course, thanks to all our storytellers. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Mike Carlisle, Alice Lewis, and Mark McGrath. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.